Welcome into episode 2 of AWA Unleashed. I'm Chris Tubbs. We are so excited to have you with us because we have had an overwhelming positive response to episode 1, where we got into the genesis of the AWA. And I know that we were excited to bring it to you. We have been so overwhelmingly thankful and grateful. And this is going to be a fun episode where we're not going to get into the stories, but one thing that we did ask you guys to do is to, when we brought up the idea, we wanted to get suggestions from you guys. And we wanted you to tell us, what is it that you guys want to hear? Because ultimately, this is a podcast for you guys, okay? I'm looking at right there. We want to know. We want to know, what is it that you guys want to know about? What do you want to hear about? Because there are things that maybe we don't think about, we don't realize. Maybe there's something that's top of mind that you're really curious about. And that's ultimately what this is about. So that's what we're going to cover today. We hear you guys, and we want to let you know that your ideas, your thoughts, they're going to get heard. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through a rapid, quick fire of some of the topics that we have on the docket. And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But enough of me. I want to bring in George Shire and Mick Karch, because obviously these are the guys that they make it go. As you can see, I'm bringing these guys in because I'm doing all the button pushing here. But before we get into it, I mentioned, guys, that I have been blown away by the response that we have received from people. It's all been positive. And again, I mean, this doesn't have to be puppies and kittens and rainbows and unicorns. I mean, if there's negative things out there and things that we're not doing right that you want us to do different, let us know. But guys, I don't know, from what I've seen, it has been just overwhelmingly positive.
Not only overwhelmingly positive, Chris, but I'm getting a lot of emails and a lot of inbox messages from people. Positive is like, that's really downplaying it, because people are so excited about this. The numbers are staggering, you know, this quickly out of the gate, out of the box. And, you know, it's word of mouth so far. And keep doing it, ladies and gentlemen. I'm telling you, talk about us, get people interested, subscribe to those channels. And we are really on a good thing here. And I'm just delighted to be a part of it.
Absolutely a mission that we are on to assure fans that we are here to listen to them. They want to know about the AWA, questions about wrestlers, personalities, characters, behind the scenes. We want to hear from you, and we're going to share with you honestly each and every week. We're going to have a topic, and we're going to give it to you, and we'll give it to you honestly, and we'll give it to you straight. And a positive response is all I've gotten. People saying, wow, great first show, and are you going to do this? Are you going to do that? We are listening. Keep them coming in, and we're going to keep you busy listening.
And as before we get into what we're going to talk about today, and again, this is just going to kind of be a rapid fire. What I'm going to do, guys, is I'm going to throw out some topics at you guys, and I want you to just, in maybe 15 to 30 seconds, just kind of tell me, when we talk about this subject, what is it that you guys are expecting? You know, what do you guys want the listeners to take out of it? And again, you can check us out on all your podcast platforms. You can see it right there. Spotify, Apple, you know, formerly known as iTunes, Pandora, iHeart, and more. Plus the YouTube channel. People love YouTube. And there's a little bit of an extra bonus, right? The Easter eggs, as they call them, when you go to YouTube. So if that's what the kids are calling it, the YouTube, I'm sure that's what the kids are calling it. But again, you can see it right there. Apple, you know, Spotify, Pandora, Google Podcast, just search anywhere, AWA Unleashed. And also, if you're on Twitter, go to AWA Unleashed. And by the way, before we do get going, if you have a question or a topic, right there, it's scrolling at the bottom. If you have an idea for us, head to Slick Mick Old School Wrestling and George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine. Put it there. Those pages, you guys are constantly on those pages, and I love it because people are active. It's pretty much, I get notifications all day. And I love it. I love that. I love that it's so engaging and it's so active. So is that the best place for people to ultimately give you guys suggestions?
I think so. You know, and my email address, which will appear a few times as we go through the broadcast. Just real quickly, you know, when I was doing SNR 30 years ago, the most popular segments were the ones that people could engage in, where there could be the back and forth, where you had the fan feedback or what have you. People love the interaction, and we want you to be engaged. We don't want to sit here and pontificate and, you know, politicize everything. We want to talk about the good old days in wrestling, and we want you to be the big part of it.
Well, if you start pontificating, I'm going to take you off screen because I don't want to see you pontificate.
That almost sounds like a bad word to me. A naughty.
Don't
word.
Worry about it.
I know. I feel like I'm going to have to.
Dick is pontificating. That's scary.
Yeah, I feel like I'm going to have to clear my browser history if I Google Mick Karch pontificate.
Now I got to go look that up in my Funkin' Wagnalls.
All right, so let's go ahead and get to it here. The first one I want to hit out of the gate, and I know it's you know, something that's near and dear to your heart, and I really want to kick it off in long term next week, but Nick Bockwinkel. I think that's somebody that is just always top of mind with fans.
Nick Bockwinkel, and obviously I'm coming at this from a very biased standpoint, the greatest ever, and I mean that. Nick could make a broomstick look good in the ring. His matches were always different. He carried the championship with dignity into other territories, into Japan. I just think the consummate professional, and there will never be another.
I would add to that I've come from a bias a little bit with Nick, too, because he is one of my personal favorites. But he's also as Mick said, a consummate professional. He went into the ring and he made you believe, and he always made you believe that his opponent was better than his opponent probably was. And that says it all when it comes to a wrestler. And he was a good guy outside the ring. We had the opportunity both together, Mick and I, and also individually, to know this man on an individual basis, to share time with him. And he was quite the gem. And those are some of the things we want to share with you guys when we get into Nick Bockwinkel specifically. And he will be one of our topics.
Yeah, I want to make him the topic, Nick. I figure there's no better way to kick it off after Vernon Wally than Nick Bockwinkel. How about Larry the Axe Hennig?
Larry the Axe Hennig, to me, should be on the Mount Rushmore of AWA wrestlers. People remember Mad Dog, they remember Crusher, but I don't think there was a more consistent mainstay, and I'm talking about a main event guy, than Larry Hennig. Every once in a while, Larry would venture to another territory, but he always found his way back to the AWA. I think from an in-ring standpoint, either as a heel or as a babyface, behind the microphone, Larry Hennig is a legitimate legend. And he was a great friend. And I really miss Larry Hennig dearly. He was just one hell of a guy.
I would echo all of that as well. And the only thing that I could add to Larry Hennig is that I think he was a man who didn't even know his own potential, his own ability in the business to get over as well as he did. Mick said he ventured off once in a while to other territories. That was very limited. Larry didn't often stray far from home. He liked it here. He wanted to be a family man and take care of his family. God bless him for that. But he lost the opportunity to go to any other territory in the country. And I mean this, all 25, 30 territories. I believe that Larry Hennig could have went in there and been the man to be on top in that territory. He was that great.
How about his son, Kurt? A lot of people know him as, you know, later on, Mr. Perfect, WWE, WWF. But, I mean, Kurt Hennig, obviously, I mean, the lineage, the heritage in that is it's second to none.
It isn't often that I would give credit to Vince McMahon Jr. for the character creations that he has done. He's come up with some winners. Kurt Hennig, Mr. Perfect. I think that was one of his major, major success stories. Kurt was it for his short career. That's sad. For his short career, he was better, in my opinion, than Ric Flair and anyone else that surrounded him. He could go into the ring. He took it from his dad. He took it from his trainers. He was trained by Vern and Billy Robinson, along with, of course, Larry. And Kurt just picked it up. He soaked it up. He was great. Nobody for his short time was better. And it's just sad that he left us as early as he did.
100% agree with George. Kurt was a phenomenal wrestler. And what's interesting about it is he had some very serious back injuries, too. You know, right in his heyday, he fought through them. I think at one point, it can be argued that Kurt was absolutely the best thing going in professional wrestling. And I know how proud Larry was of him. You know, until the day Larry passed, he would always talk about Kurt. And then, of course, the lineage to Curtis Axel, to Joe Hennig. Outside the ring, you would not find a more brilliant swerver, jokester, ribber, whatever you want to call it, than Kurt Hennig. And there are some stories about Kurt that are just beyond. But he was a great friend. It was an honor to work with him in the AWA. And I remember very vividly, right towards the end of my time in AWA, I asked Kurt how things are going. And Kurt's champion at the time. And Kurt said to me, he says, you know, this is okay, but I got an offer to go someplace else. Don't tell anybody, so on and so forth. And boy, did that pan out.
When we finally get to talk about Kurt in length, which we will do, fans, I want to share some stories behind the scenes about Kurt and Larry. And we'll save that for that show.
Let's go to another second generation and maybe another one that is as, you know, as well known as anybody. And that's Greg Gagne.
Greg Gagne, and I know he's a close personal friend of George's, so George can elaborate on this. I don't think there is a guy that is less deserving of some of the animosity that he gets online from wrestling fans. I think Greg was a tremendous in-ring talent. People talk about his lack of size. Well, you know what? Jeff Jarrett isn't the biggest guy in the world. You know, Kevin Von Erich isn't the biggest guy. I mean, so you could go on and on. Greg was so good at putting guys over, whether it was a monster heel like Bruiser Brody or Yokozuna or Jerry Blackwell, and then you could flip it. He, Ian Brunzel against Santana and Martel. He was so loyal to the business in terms of protecting it. I think Greg was a consummate professional, and I don't remember seeing a bad match with Greg Gagne.
I tell that to fans all the time. I followed and I saw every Twin Cities match that Greg was in from the beginning of his career to the very end of his career, and I saw him in other cities as well. I never saw Greg in a bad match. Greg always knew how to work with his opponents, how to put them over, and how to also, you know, be put over. And Greg was a guy who, when we get to talking about Greg in one of our future episodes, I want to tell the stories about Greg has shared with me, how he and his dad worked together and how his dad deliberately didn't put the title on Greg for so many reasons, but all the things Greg had to go through behind the scenes with other wrestlers because he was the owner's son. There's a lot of stuff that people don't understand, but Greg was the real deal. Yeah, he wasn't as big, you know, Mick named some guys. Well, I tell you what, Shawn Michaels wasn't the biggest guy in the business either. So Greg, he doesn't get what he deserves. He was underrated, and that's, we'll leave it at that until we talk about him at length.
I just want to toss in one more point, Chris, about Greg and the size issue. When Greg was first getting into the business, George will remember this, he had a couple of real serious bouts of mononucleosis. Yeah. And in both cases, you know, he lost weight. I remember one night at the TV studio, I looked in the back of Greg's car as I was entering the building, and there's cans of weight gain and Nutriment and protein powders. And this poor guy did everything that he could to gain weight and muscle and what have you. In reality, he didn't need it because he was just such a great in-ring worker. But that's the knock on Greg Gagne all these years. Oh, he wasn't big enough. Mm-hmm. Who cares? Who gives a rat's ass?
When we do get into depth with Greg and his story, just hearing how he had to deal with the business because he was the boss's son. You know, that's something that it's hard to not only live down, but live up to. Mm-hmm. So we'll get to that when we talk about Greg, but a great worker, absolutely great guy.
How about Eddie Sharkey? I know a lot of us know him as a trainer, and we know a lot of the names that are associated, but I mean, Eddie Sharkey is somebody that I've seen brought up multiple times that people want to know about.
George, go ahead.
Well, Mick knows Eddie a lot better than I do, but I've worked with Eddie and I've been around Eddie. And my take on Eddie is that, first of all, he was a hell of a worker. You talk about guys not being big enough. Eddie Sharkey was not a big guy, professional wrestling standards. He was always in that light heavyweight or junior heavyweight range when he was working. I can tell you this, he had some phenomenal matches with Bob Boyer and Danny Hodge. So he was good. He was a great worker. I found him to be Eddie. Sometimes you don't know if you could take him seriously or not. He was a joker. He had some wit about him and certain other wrestlers, and something would spill out and he'd have you in stitches. And that's what I remember Eddie is. And of course he did. He was a great trainer, brought a lot of guys into the business. So when we get to Eddie, we'll expound more on that. And then Mick, you share what you have here.
Eddie Sharkey has been a great friend for 40, 50 years. And I'm telling you, you know, I've alluded to some of the wrestlers and say, oh, you wouldn't believe some of the stories about these guys. Eddie Sharkey is one of those guys. I think Eddie would be the first to admit, and very proudly, his reputation as a swerver, as a bit of a little bit of a carny, but he wears that title proudly. And again, so many years I've been associating with Eddie. He really is the guy. You can blame Eddie. He's the guy that actually got my foot in the door as far as doing announcing for TV wrestling. So great stories to Eddie.
How about Sodbuster Kenny J?
Oh.
Wow. Kenny J, I really believe in my heart of hearts, if he would have committed himself to being a full-time wrestler, he probably could have went pretty much to the top. He was good. And Kenny is one of those guys where most wrestlers will tell you that if they didn't have Kenny J to put him over, they probably wouldn't have been over. So Kenny was good. He did his job. And outside the ring, oh man, you can't find a more fun guy to spend time with. He's a jokester. He likes to have a good time. I don't think he's always got the facts straight, but I love him. Kenny J's great.
Kenny J, people have asked me who's the nicest guy you met in wrestling. And I tell you, if he's not number one, he's right up there because, as George said, outside the ring, a little bit of a jokester. Kenny likes to, you know, once in a while, he'll have a little sip, as he did quite often in his Kenny J benefits on behalf of histiocytosis. But a tremendous wrestler. He's one of those guys. You ask wrestling fans, you know, who do you remember from back in the glory days? They'll talk about, you know, the main stars, but they'll always talk about Kenny J. And I just can't say enough superlatives about Kenny. One thing I will tell you, you know, he had that infamous match with Muhammad Ali, boxer versus wrestler, back, you know, in the middle 1970s. And Kenny told me, he said, they told me to go easy on him. He said, I could have leg-dived this guy and finished him off in about 15 seconds.
And I want to add one thing. When you mentioned that Muhammad Ali debacle with Antonio Inoki, I guarantee you that had they made that paper or that closed circuit event, if they'd have put Kenny J against Muhammad Ali, that would have been, and I mean this in all my heart, that would have been a better match than what we got for what we paid for at the time. We'll talk about Kenny down the road.
Well, we started it with Nick Bockwinkel. There's a name that's associated with Nick Bockwinkel, and that's Bobby the Brain Heenan. People love him. See, I see you, Mick, right there. If you say the words Bobby the Brain Heenan, people chuckle because I think over the course of time, people have just really grown to admire the personality that Bobby Heenan was. And he was such a big part, I feel, from what I understand, from what I hear from you guys, of why the Nick Bockwinkel heel champion thing worked.
I would go so far as to say that Bobby Heenan is the best overall wrestling talent ever. And by that, I mean not only the managing skills, not only with the heel persona that got people into the building like that, but as a wrestler, he took bumps all over the ring. He was just an extraordinary worker. Nick Bockwinkel used to say, you know, if Ray Stevens or I didn't make a town for whatever reason, we were sick, travel, whatever, and they put Bobby Heenan in our place, not only did the fans pop, they loved the replacement, but he said the match was as good or better than anything we can deliver. Bobby Heenan stories, I have several that I'll share over the coming weeks, but to me, absolutely par excellence, he is the man as far as the history of wrestling, at least in the modern era.
One of the things that we can do when we talk about Bobby Heenan stories is Bobby Heenan on the microphone. When he came in the interview area for his 2 or 3 minutes, absolutely, that was must-listen TV. And if you listen closely, Bobby, who ad-libbed all this stuff, he didn't have a script. He just knew what he was going to talk about, and boom, he went. And he could make you, if you thought about it, he made you laugh. The things that he came up with, the impromptu comments that he made. And when we talk about Bobby in depth, we're going to share some of those things. And then I'll also share a personal story that I had with Bobby Heenan myself. And it really showed me what kind of a guy he was outside the ring. So Bobby Heenan, future episode, it's going to be incredible.
Just one quick comment. Bobby Heenan, George talked about his wit. If this guy, if he liked you, boy, you were in good shape. If he didn't like you, you never wanted to get into a verbal jousting with Bobby Heenan. Oh,
you'd lose.
Because Nick used to say, this guy is going to slice and dice you. And believe me, he was like a Vegematic once he got going. You had no chance to go back and forth with Bobby Heenan.
When we talk about some of the interviews that he did and some of the little personal stories, I think that fans looking forward to that episode of AWA Unleashed, you're going to be amazed at Bobby Heenan. He may have been the AWA's best character of all time.
Yep.
Well, these are just some of the individuals, guys, that we're going to go through. Again, we've got a lot more. I mean, we haven't even hit like a third of the individuals that we're going to hit. And these are all listener suggestions. And if you guys have a listener suggestion or an idea or a topic, said right there on the bottom of the screen, if you're looking at YouTube, head to Slick Mick Old School Wrestling and George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine. Put it out there. Let us know, because I think we could plan at least a year and a half in advance with what we've got. And that's just from the very beginning. Let's go to some of the events, because I know there are individuals and there are events and topics people want to hear. I know one of the most infamous ones that people want to hear about is what happened with WrestleRock. And I know that's one thing that we're going to talk about. Well, I'm going to ask. You guys are going to talk.
Go ahead, George.
Well, you know, here's the thing with WrestleRock. I was there. I will tell you that probably it was advertised as the biggest, most extravaganza type card ever presented, at least in AWA land. In 86, we'd already been privy to some pay-per-view events. We'd already seen the first WrestleMania, etc., from the rival groups. And there were super clashes and things. But WrestleRock, it was a concept that probably was so good on paper, but it just didn't come off. And I'm only going to offer this. I thought it was a great card that tried to give us too much. I think you could have taken out of the 115 million matches that were on that card, you could have taken half of them off and the card would have been better. And we can go into detail on that at another time, I think, but the matches that could have drawn, I think they would have drawn better if there wasn't so much around them. I just thought there was too much. Vern tried too hard. And then, of course, the old critic, you know, he calls it Wrestle Rock, and we got Waylon Jennings, a country star, doing, you know, I don't know if Vern didn't know what rock music was. I don't know. I don't know if that was all he could get at the last, you know, maybe Elton John didn't show up. I don't know. But it was a good card, but it could have been better if it would have been handled a little bit differently and a lot less supposed talent trying to come in. I think Vern was trying, literally, I think he was trying too hard to try to go against McMahon at that point in time. And in doing so, the fans and WrestleRock got shortchanged.
A couple of things that I remember about WrestleRock, and I agree with George. On paper, it sounded like this was going to be the blockbuster of all blockbusters, and it fell short. Some of the matches were just great. Others, absolutely. One that comes to mind was Giant Baba and Bulldog Bob Brown. And George, you were there, you saw it. Have you ever seen a marquee wrestling match that was worse than that one?
Well, I probably have seen a worse match, but that one was pretty much near the top. You know, the thing is, this card advertised, without looking at it, I don't remember. I think there were like 15 matches on the card, 15 or 16. And the thing is, you have to realize that with pro wrestling is that it's not the number of matches that count. It's the quality of the matches that are on the card. And this is why back in our day, I saw many spot shows, as they were called, in a small town where you'd go and have three matches on the card, or maybe four, but usually three. And I can tell you that some of those spot shows far outclassed what WrestleRock delivered because there was too much. If you got 18 matches on the card, that's great, but you don't have time to tell a story with them. You don't have time to do what you should be doing with them. And you're trying to just shove so many stars down the fan's throat. And I agree with you. Bob, when I think about that again, you're right. Bob Brown and Giant Baba couldn't have been more worse. Two guys who certainly did not deserve to be in the ring with each other ever.
One last comment about WrestleRock. Yeah, because I can look at you, Chris, and I know you want to move this thing along. You know, you talk about Ric Flair's chops and the woos and everything else over the years. Some guys that deliver that knife-edge chop. Wahoo McDaniel wrestled Colonel DeBeers, I believe, that night, and I was shooting pictures at ringside for Pro Wrestling Illustrated. I have never seen a guy get lit up with chops more than Colonel DeBeers did. I mean, you could hear those chops echo out onto, you know, 6th Street, the old Dyckman Hotel. I've never seen anything like it. The blood vessels were popped in his chest. This poor guy looked like a road map of Santa Monica by the time Wahoo got done with him. All right, there you go.
I don't know what that had to do with Bob Brown and Giant Baba, but
I wanted to get off of that topic as soon as we could.
You and I have some great Bob Brown stories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and there
we'll, we'll throw them in there.
How about the super clashes? Do you guys can you talk about that a little more favorably than WrestleRock?
I'll start out and let Mick finish on this one. The super clashes were getting to that end of the era of the AWA, and that's ahead of where we want to be at this point. But here's the problem as I saw it. Again, Vern was trying hard to compete with McMahon and in many ways trying to copy McMahon, which I personally have always felt was a mistake. He should have stuck tried and true to the Vern Gagne formula of putting on a good 5 or 6 bout card and giving the fans the best talent that he could, instead of coming up with a 10 or 12 or 15 bout alleged super spectacular where everybody is in there trying to get their spotlight and their move and everything in. And I think that's why the super clashes for me were not memorable. But behind the scenes stories, we can go into a few of those down the road too.
The one thing I would talk about with the Super Clash is, unfortunately, was Super Clash 3.
Oh, boy.
Which, as you go back in history, that really did not do the AWA any good. I mean, they were starting this, you know, they were trying to stay afloat back then. But that was held in Chicago, and the live attendance was absolutely abysmal. And Vern lost an awful lot of money on that. And, you know, this is, again, Vern trying too hard. This is when he's trying to work with all these other promotions, the World Classes, and, you know, Jerry Lawler in Memphis, and Jerry as AWA champion. Super Clash 3 was one of the bigger nails in the coffin, as far as I'm concerned, for the AWA. Coulda, shoulda, but man, it didn't. So there you go.
Let's go one more here, guys, and then we'll actually move on to some other topics. In terms of the events, bring my notes up here. The Team Challenge Series. I know that's my daughter would say that's cringy when people are talking about the Team Challenge Series. But I know that that's, unfortunately, it's something that people want to talk about, and people have questions about that.
My memory of the Team Challenge Series was I sat in my chair in my living room, and I realized that all that I had seen previous to this with the AWA was indeed over. The nail, as Mick called it before, was in the coffin, and the coffin was being closed. The Team Challenge showed me that the AWA had completely lost all creativity. They had lost all ability to put on any type of a card that made any sense that a fan would legitimately want to watch or see. And that was, I mean, I had turned it off. It's a memory I don't want to have. I don't want to go back to it. It was bad. It was over.
The Team Challenge Series, I think in theory and on paper, would have been a good idea because, you know, you've got this ongoing tournament or what have you. First of all, the talent level at some places in that roster at the time did not at all match the hype for the event. The other thing that I would say is when you are at a point where you're putting a fried chicken eating contest as one part of the Team Challenge Series, that really goes to show you exactly what they were. And it's so sad because so much of the modern day fan base who came into the professional wrestling world at the AWA right about then, that's the first big event that they remember.
And that's the memory that they have.
Yeah.
Is that now they don't associate, you know, the heyday, the Crusher, Baron, Nick Bonk. They don't associate that. They instantly think to those sort of things that they're seeing, you know, on ESPN when they're coming home after school or whatnot.
You know, Chris, it's by then the AWA is running the shows in Rochester, Minnesota. The TV production did not look that great. And it was just everything was unraveling. And I don't think, like George said, there is no better indicator. There's no better snapshot in time of how bad off the AWA was than the Team Challenge Series. If we could erase that from the AWA record books like it never happened, that would be a good thing. The proof is in the pudding. Everybody that was associated with the AWA, when people say, well, whose idea was it? Who is this? Everybody's tossing the ball to somebody else. Well, I didn't come up with it. He did. And no, it was his idea to put this guy in there. So nobody wants to take responsibility for it. And again, it's so sad that that's part of the AWA legacy.
You know, one of the things I want to add when you talk about that first memory or that first exposure to anything, and especially as a wrestling fan. When I was growing up in the 50s and into the 60s, I'm going to tell you a wrestler that was a whirlwind in the ring, and he was so phenomenal to watch and entertaining, and that was Pat O'Connor. Now, in the early 80s, Nick Bockwinkel wrestled against Pat O'Connor in the St. Paul Civic Center in a match that was touted as being a big deal because Pat O'Connor was a former world champion, you know, this and that, and he was going to give Nick a solid test. And Nick literally had to carry that match. And it was so sad for me because Pat O'Connor, he was way past his prime. He was close to 60 years old. He could barely do anything in the ring. And here was a guy who was living literally on his reputation only. And he didn't even really have that great of a reputation in the Twin City area at that point in time. But Nick put him over. And it was sad for me because if that would have been my very first time after all this hype I'd heard about Pat O'Connor, and I see this guy get in the ring, I would have said, you know, everything you ever said about him isn't true. And that's what the team challenge was. It was trying to create stuff that the AWA had lost their direction. Like Mick says, nobody wants to take credit for it.
Yeah.
They were all involved. They were all at fault and none want to take the blame.
Well, let's move on here. Cause you mentioned that the St. Paul Civic Center, I know that it's a very popular building in terms of the wrestling history. I know Mick, I see that you've got, you know, the old Metropolitan, you know, the Metropolitan that was, you know, where Mall of America is now, or the parking lot. But I know some people want to get into, you know, the historical context for the people in the upper Midwest and the Twin Cities where we're, you know, we're based out of, the St. Paul Civic Center, because it was a place where a lot of big time cards and big time events were held.
The St. Paul Civic Center was actually the last venue that the AWA was using on a major basis. Mm-hmm. And the reason it was popular at that point in time was because wrestling in the early 80s, 81, 82, 83, 84, had risen in popularity so much with a new fan base and the talent roster that we had. Wrestling around the country all over was drawing bigger crowds. The Civic Center housed about 20,000, you know, just for general purposes. So to have a wrestling card there and you could draw 20,000, it was great. Before that, we always had in the Twin Cities, we had the St. Paul Auditorium or the Minneapolis Auditorium, and a capacity crowd in those two particular venues was around 10,000, 9,000, 10,000, which in its heyday was a big deal because that's what any, you know, event held there would want to draw. But the Civic Center for the last 3 or 4 years was really, really great. And what's sad about it is that as we moved into the 80s and the invasion took place, the Civic Center now holding a card when it holds 20,000 people and you only have 3,000 there, that makes it look really bad. But it was a great place for wrestling for probably about 4 or 5 years that it was run.
What I remember about the Civic Center, first of all, when I think back to it, it's the Hulk Hogan era. You know, and we talked last week about the incredible crowds month after month, rather, where they would sell out the building ahead of time and have standing room only tickets. The Civic Center is a great building. In my mind's eye, it's like that's the separation of my wrestling memory in terms of eras. You had, like George said, the Minneapolis Auditorium, St. Paul Auditorium, Minneapolis Armory, going back before then, the old buildings that housed wrestling. And then all of a sudden you had this St. Paul Civic Center, which with double the attendance capacity. So in my mind, there's that separation. The one thing that I will remember about the Civic Center is the number of fights in the stands. And I'm telling you, it was over and over again. You'd watch people getting hauled out of the building. One memory I think that stands out, and I know we can move on to another topic, was the reaction of the crowd the night that Hulk Hogan defeated Nick Bockwinkel and then they reversed the decision. That is as close to a full-scale riot as I can remember in Twin Cities wrestling. So that's a memory that I connect with the Civic Center.
And I want to add this. When we talk about those bigger crowds, 20,000, I agree with Mick. I came home several times after attending those cards with that attendance, and I was getting to the point where I wasn't enjoying being in the building anymore because the crowd, as I mentioned earlier, the crowd base, the crowd type of fan had changed. We had people there that literally they were fighting amongst themselves. It was a different audience. And I also like to point out that when you talk about having 20,000 fans in that building, that was once a month back at that time. You know, people think, well, that's a big deal. They were drawing $20,000 a month. But I'd like to reflect back on the days when the AWA ran two cards a week, one on a Saturday and one on a Thursday, or a Tuesday and a Saturday. Minneapolis, St. Paul, going back and forth. And if you drew $3,000-$4,000 at each of those cards, and you do that for a monthly basis, you know, you're drawing 20,000 people. They were doing it just a little bit differently. Instead of putting on one big card a month, they were putting on four smaller cards or eight smaller cards. And then they used to run twice a month. So there's a lot of variation when you talk about, well, the attendance went up. But that Civic Center, I didn't like the big crowds and I didn't like the change in the fans. And that was different from what I had grown up for the previous 20 years.
Yeah, and I was just making some notes about the Minneapolis St. Paul Auditorium and the Armory, because I think I want to go back and I want to, you know, touch on that when we get into the whole building thing. How about enhancement talent? Because I know we look at it now, and I think there's a newfound appreciation and respect for the quote unquote jobbers or the enhancement talent now that that we know them as.
I think there were two types of enhancement talents. We mentioned Kenny Jay earlier, and you throw in George Gadaski and Kenny Yates, and we can go down the list of some guys. Those were enhancement talent guys that were, for all practical purposes, even though they weren't wrestling full time, they were full time wrestlers in the sense that wherever they were asked to go, whatever they were asked to do, they went and did it. And then the other type of enhancement talent was a guy that would come in, pick up his $20 or whatever to do TV. He had no interest in the business. He wasn't a regular in the business. He maybe did it for a short period of time. He had really no following. They introduced him. It meant nothing. He changed his name from city to city. And that didn't matter. But the Kenny Jays, the George Gadaskis of our territory, Kenny Yates, and there are so many others. You know, I remember we had Jose Quintaro. He was enhancement talent, but Jose was a hell of a worker. You know, it wasn't like watching Jimmy Do. When they introduced Jimmy Do, what can Jimmy Do do? Jimmy Do does nothing. He could do nothing. It didn't matter. So I think that's the difference. I admire, when we talk about enhancement talent down the road, I think we can tell you some very interesting stories. And Jimmy Do, Rooster Griffin, are you serious?
We're going to have so many stories about the enhancement talent. And one thing that I would say, Kenny Jay, George Gadaski, Nacho Barrera probably, and Jake Milliman, and Tom Rocky Stone, my good buddy Tom Stone, over there in Milwaukee.
Tom Stone was good.
They are, I think, the most identifiable because they were consistently on television. But the AWA would bring in a carload of guys. They'd start in Chicago, you know, as a carpool. They'd move their way on to Milwaukee, pick up a couple of guys in Milwaukee. You probably had 7-8 guys crammed into a Volkswagen. And they would come in to do TV. And George mentioned the amount of money they got paid. Well, first of all, sometimes they wrestled twice, sometimes three times, you know, in a weekend if they put them on a house show. I'm guessing, because I've heard this, they got a little bit more money, believe it or not, than the established stars got for television. Because, A, they were wrestling a couple of matches, and, B, because the superstars were making their money at the big house shows.
Right.
But you get your one time I did a poll on the Slick Mick page and I just said, name some of the enhancement guys that you remember from the AWA. My God, you would have thought it was the graduation list from West Point. On and on and on. You're getting 150, 200 names, guys that you would completely forget about. Woody Wilson and Herman Schaefer, Arnold Rodriguez, Cesar Pabon, Zapata, who I think changed his name about 15, 20 times in one night. We had Moose Morawski, who eventually was kind of a mid-card talent in the AWA. He came in and wrestled as Mike Jankowski, Mike Pulaski, and who knows, Bette Midler. I don't know how many names they gave this guy. But the enhancement guys are what made the stars look good, like George said. And I'm telling you, there are some Angel Rivera. There's another one. Isn't it horrible that I'm sitting here in my advanced age and I'm remembering all these guys that came in and laid down in 2 minutes 50 years ago? So that's the impact of the enhancement guys.
I would also like to point out, when we talk about enhancement guys down the road, the AWA was well known for the fact you mentioned Moose Borowski. You know, these were some guys that were enhancement talent in the AWA. They were stars in other territories, and they did work in the business on a full-time basis. When you talk about Moose Borowski or the Great Dane, these were guys that they were working the territories. They came into Vern, and they were enhancement talent. Not to mention, we used enhancement talent in the AWA of guys that either were in the beginnings of their career and went on to greater talent. I mean, Terry Funk. I saw Terry Funk lose on TV a few times in the 60s as a jobber. Well, we know Terry Funk's story. And we could go on and on naming guys that were major stars either shortly after or even during their career of jobbing in the Twin Cities. But
Roddy Piper.
Yeah. I mean, did he go anywhere in the business? Of course.
I heard of him.
I heard he did.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, George.
No, I was just going to say, Vern always had some interesting guys in the matches that made them believable. You know, when you talk about the enhancement talent, I could make you a list of guys that were either highlighting in other cards or even main eventing in other territories, and they come in here and they do a job. That's great. That's why the AWA was so darn good, because we had talent even in the TV matches.
Quick AWA enhancement talent story. Guy named Hank Meadows.
Oh, geez.
There were two Hank Meadows. One was a wrestler, so to speak, and the other one had a cooking show on Channel 11. Well, Hank Meadows, the wrestler, he was about, if he stood sideways, you couldn't see him. I mean, he was like the size of a straw. And he came in, I remember this vividly because I was at the TV studio that night, 2 out of 3 fall match against Larry Hennig. Well, it was the dead of summer, and right across the street from the TV studios was the Calhoun Beach. And Hank Meadows apparently had spent the afternoon in the hot sun over at Lake Calhoun. He came in. This poor guy looked like a sausage, you know, on the butcher shelf at the grocery store. He was that burned up. And Larry Hennig took full took full advantage of Hank Meadows' sunburn. He pounded this guy so many times, leaving these white handprints all over Hank Meadows. This is the God's truth, Chris. Hank Meadows, the only guy in history in the AWA that could not come back for the second fall because of sunburn and handprints.
True.
And that's a fact.
True. And you know what? I want to throw one more story in there. In one of our episodes, we're going to talk about the outstanding referees and how important a referee was to any match in any territory at any time in history. And they're underrated. But we had a referee by the name of Marty Miller.
Oh.
And in my opinion, I thought Marty, he not only didn't look the part, but Marty was one of the best referees we ever had, because he was so good at missing everything that the bad guys did. And the fans could be shouting to him. They could be putting up posters. They could be yelling over the PA system, you know, that he used brass knuckles. And Marty was oblivious to it. He was the greatest referee in the world. But I remember when Dr. X was at his height in the AWA, he had been here for about a year. He'd wrestled a who's who. Everybody wanted a shot at taking off his mask and revealing the ugly mug under the mask, you know, the whole story. Because they said he was too ugly. That's why he put a mask on. Well, Marty Miller, he came out and he said, now, Marty Miller's never wrestled a match in his life. He referees. He comes out and he said he thought that he could beat Dr. X, and he was, because he's watched him in the matches that he's refereed, and he wants a chance at him. So Marty O'Neill, our ring announcer, gets in there and gives that spiel that Marty Miller is going to take a chance at Dr. X on TV. Well, Marty Miller's making his wrestling debut, ladies and gentlemen. And the bell rings. The doc picks him up, slams him to the mat, puts the figure four on him, and the match was shorter than any match that McMahon has ever played. It was literally, I don't think it was 10 seconds. And they carried poor Marty out, his legs broken, you know, up here.
One quick Marty Miller, Marty Miller aside, Marty used to tell me, he said, when I come out at the Civic Center Auditorium, as soon as the fans saw me come out for the main event, they knew it was going to be an F-bomb finish. Yep. They just knew there was always controversy with Marty Miller. That's how he made his living. But again, he's one of these guys. People remember whatever happened to that guy that was built like a bowling ball with legs. Oh yeah, Marty Miller.
And the thing is, when we talk about referees,
we got to wrap it up here quick, guys.
We got a whole list, and it'll be fun.
We'll discuss some of the referees. Again, these are just some of the topics that we have. We've got a whole lot more. We haven't even hit half of them, you guys. And if you've got some suggestions, head to Slick Mick Old School Wrestling, George Shire's Wrestling Time Machine, and follow on Twitter at AWA Unleashed. All right, before I promote the platforms again, I know at the end of the show, Mick, I'm putting it right there. We've got AWA Trivia, and tell us the winner of last week, and what do we have this week in terms of our trivia question?
Well, last week, and there were several people that actually got the answer right. I asked you who was the man that was called a matchmaker in the Twin Cities area, along with Vern Gagne and Wally Carbo, the hierarchy in the AWA. Bill Cacisto was the answer that I'm looking for. Not a lot of wrestling fans modern day might remember Bill, but he was a big presence in the AWA. The name that I drew from everybody that had the right answer, it was my friend Andy Hammerlink in St. Paul, Minnesota. Andy's going to get some wrestling memorabilia from me that I can part with. Maybe I got an 8x10 of Shire I can put in the mail. I don't know. I can certainly part with that very easily. But this question goes back to the 1970s AWA, and I want to know which wrestler AWA, as part of his promotional package and feats of strength, pulled a full-size MTC bus, probably 10, 15 feet on television as part of, again, the demonstrating the feats of strength. So I'll send you some more memorabilia. If you know that, we're giving them 48 hours. All the winners' names go into a hat. We'll pick one, and you're going to be a winner.
So you've got until January 13th. This is dropping on the 11th. So you've got until January 13th to email you, Mick, at mickkarch@gmail.com. That right?
Correct.
All right. Or they can head to your guys' Facebook pages. They can answer. Basically, either one of those two will work for people to get in contact with you.
Yes, sir.
All right.
You can also private message me on the Facebook Time Machine page. You do that private message, we can take it from there.
Awesome. Well, again, guys, this is just, we've got so many more things that we are going to hit on, and we haven't even hit on a good majority of them. We maybe hit on half of them. And if you've got ideas, let us know. Go to Facebook pages, go to Twitter. You can email whatever you feel comfortable doing. And you can see right there, again, if you're looking at YouTube, catch us on all your favorite podcast platforms, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Google, Amazon, and more. Just search AWA Unleashed. Or if you want to catch us on YouTube, just search AWA Unleashed. I've turned my personal YouTube page into something for fans. And we are excited. We are extremely grateful for all of the overwhelming positivity. And again, go there, rate, review, and subscribe. The rating and the reviewing, that's one of the main ways to help us grow. And to subscribe to the YouTube channel and check that out. There are a lot of ways if you guys want to help us grow, because this is about you guys. This is a podcast, I think, guys. I want to give back to the people that are giving us the admiration. But this is about them. This is about what you guys want to hear. So I feel like it's about as fan-friendly as we can be. Ultimately, that's the ultimate goal at the end of the day.
I want to thank everybody. The response has been just fantastic and so overwhelmingly positive. And we're loving this. I mean, hopefully the listeners and the viewers are enjoying it as much as we are. But this is our trip back in time. And not a lot of us guys left that can talk about the old days. So it's just a pleasure. Keep subscribing, everybody. Like Chris said, that's the key.
And I just want to say the same thing. We really appreciate all the support. And I want to always say thank you, Chris, for taking us on this journey. Yep. Because you're the man behind the scenes and you're the one feeding us some of this information. And we love you, man. So you're part of this three-man tag team.
What happened to your microphone?
See, I'm trying to do too many things. I see. There we go. I felt like the director was cutting me off here.
Where's El Derusha when you need him, George?
I know.
How can a guy working in radio not remember to put his mic on?
Hey, this is complicated shit, guys. Come on.
Yeah, I love you.
Come on.
That's great.
To quote a TV star long ago forgotten, body slams and pinfalls, everybody, to you and yours.